This is KUNM. I'm May Ortega. The Archdiocese of Santa Fe updated their website last week with more information about where and when priests accused of sexual abuse worked in New Mexico. As Public Health New Mexico's Hannah Colton reports, the new information follows up on a promise the Archdiocese made last fall.
Nearly a year after the list was first published, the Archdiocese has filled in the dates and locations where each man was assigned. They also added four new names, bringing the total to 78 priests or other clergymen the church believes have been credibly accused of sexual abuse. Levi Monagle has represented dozens of victims and says the Archdiocese is still leaving out many names that should be on the list.
So that people know whether or not their children might have had contact with some of these guys. I think that an accurate list, a comprehensive list, would be as inclusive as possible, not as narrowly limited as possible.
Monagle works with the law offices of Brad D. Hall in Albuquerque. They named Robert Galley and Thaddeus Mazur, both of whom are dead, in two lawsuits this year. Later, the Archdiocese added them to the list. Also new to the list are Tom McConnell and Richard Hennessy. The Archdiocese of Santa Fe did not respond to a request for comment for this story. For KUNM, I'm Hannah Colton.
Support for KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the McEwen Charitable Foundation, the Con Alma Health Foundation, and from KUNM listeners like you.
You've given the Archdiocese of Santa Fe and the Diocese of Gallup and Las Cruces until October 5th to produce records on dozens of priests accused of sexually abusing children. What kinds of information does your office already have on these priests, and what are you hoping to find?
Well, we began an investigation March of 2016. We quickly realized that the magnitude of the problem really needed to be addressed through a full-scale review of the diocese in New Mexico.
Specifically, what kinds of records are you hoping to obtain?
Well, financial records, personnel records, starting from top to bottom, I need to gauge not only how much the cover-up played a role in this tragedy, but more importantly, truly getting a sense of the victims. The numbers just don't add up right now. We studied the amount of civil disclosures through litigation and lawsuits, and I believe there are many more families that have been impacted negatively. So we were requesting vast amount of documentation to really gain an understanding from 1950 to the current state of affairs. I wanted to make sure that I started with a sample that is not only concrete, but really gives me a full gauge of multi-generational abuse that clearly has been confirmed.
The majority of the sexual abuse cases that could be uncovered by this investigation likely happened many years ago. Too long ago for criminal prosecutions?
That's correct. Most of the conduct that we are going to be investigating probably will lead us to very limited criminal remedies. But that doesn't mean I can't have an honest conversation with the legislature about reopening up civil statute of limitations to maybe create a treatment fund or some kind of public health funds necessary so that victim families can draw these funds down. I think it's absurd that you can file a uranium claim, but you can't file a treatment claim if you've somehow been harmed by the church. These may be some of the recommendations that we come forward with.
Attorneys and advocates for abuse survivors have also called upon you to enlist a grand jury, like the one in Pennsylvania that worked for 2 years and recently released a massive report. Will you impanel a grand jury here, and what would it have the power to do?
There may be a grand jury impaneled for the clergy abuse system, but right now I believe the cover-up is probably too widespread. And I want to come out first with some type of report. We are starting very broadly, much larger than even a grand jury would be focused on if they were impaneled today. And so I'm not saying we won't impanel a grand jury. What I'm saying is that I believe the level of abuse is so horrific that you do not want to give direction to your law enforcement unit by itself or impanel a grand jury with limited information.
The Catholic Church is beloved to many in New Mexico, deeply embedded in our state's culture. The church is also historically secretive about their internal affairs. So how can your office push for protection for children now and into the future when it comes to such a powerful institution? And what lasting changes would you like to see?
Well, the first is that we're using the rule of law on an organization that lives off of trust. And I'm a former altar boy and a Santa Clara member of one of the most rural church communities in northern New Mexico. So I totally understand the conflict and the mixed feelings that New Mexicans have about this type of investigation. But one thing that I will have very little patience for is not speaking the truth in terms of where all the failures were. Yes, the church covered up and failed, but we're also going to use a lot of this documentation to investigate the environment that was surrounding the church. There was a legal environment and a political environment. Turning a blind eye may have been something that was occurring outside in these environments. And these are the conversations that I'm having with these 40 and 50-year-old victims that are very angry with the system. There were local DAs that got letters in the 80s and 90s. Where are those letters today? So when we investigate within the church, I think we're going to find leads that lead to other areas of analysis. We have to come clean. We truly have to come clean as a state. Why was New Mexico allowed to be a dumping ground? Was it just the church within, or were there other legal institutions that were dramatically failing that need to have an honest conversation about clergy abuse in New Mexico?
Attorney General Hector Balderas, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Father Weisenborn was a priest from the East Coast who was caught on multiple occasions sexually abusing young boys by police. They would come to his order back east and say, hey, you know, you need to do something about this. But Father Weisenborn's order, when they reached out to the servants as to whether or not they would accept Father Weisenborn, the servant said, yeah, we will. We would like a $10,000 donation to come along with him, but we'll take him. And so they did. But within a few years, Father Weisenborn was assigned to New Mexico parishes, including St. Francis Xavier Parish on South Broadway here in Albuquerque. And he abused a number of children there.
Priests that were accused of sexual misconduct in any part of the U.S. could be sent to Jemez Springs for a few months or longer. Would they have had any contact with children during that time period?
Well, the servants lost a lot of files over the years, so we don't know exactly what the day-to-day life of a paraclete priest looked like. We do know priests who were sent to the servants of the paraclete were not kept under lock and key. They did have freedom to travel. Certainly, there were times where priests who were sent to the servants of the paraclete in Jemez Springs were in contact with children during their treatment duration.
Currently, the Archdiocese acknowledges these 78 priests. You're saying that you think the Archdiocese should acknowledge any and all priests accused of sexually abusing kids anywhere who then spent time within the boundaries of the Archdiocese of Santa Fe. Is that right?
That's correct.
Why? Explain a little more.
The logic of putting together a list of credibly accused priests is that if you knew where these guys were and you knew when they were in particular places, you might be able to reach out to potential victims. The priests that were at the servants of the paraclete, I don't know if the archdiocese knows or not which of those priests were working in New Mexico. If they know and they aren't telling, that's a problem. And if they don't know, then that's also a problem. Right, because what we're trying to do is risk assessment and sort of pick up the pieces in all of this and try to help people who may have been harmed. The first task there, if you're doing that kind of triage, is assessing the scope of the damage accurately.
Last month, a Pennsylvania grand jury report that drew national attention included several priests accused of horrible sexual abuse who were then sent to New Mexico for treatment. There's at least 10 by my count. New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas has recently said he's been in communication with the Pennsylvania Attorney General. If the New Mexico Attorney General does launch a similar investigation, what do you make of that, that this is happening now and not a year ago when the Archdiocese published their list?
Sometimes you have to lead by example. I think that's what the Attorney General and the Pennsylvania grand jury did. I can't fault, you know, Mr. Balderas for not being the first one to think of doing this. And, I know he has a lot on his plate. But now, at this moment, when the iron's hot, I think it's really, really crucial that Mr. Balderas impanel a grand jury and let them investigate the history of this issue in New Mexico. I think we're still seeing the public health fallout of widespread childhood sexual abuse through the decades, whether that's drugs, whether that's domestic violence, whether that's just depression or suicide. It plays out over time. You know, we're calling on Mr. Balderas to impanel a grand jury, to back that grand jury with investigative power and let them dig into this issue. I think it's crucial.
As an attorney who's represented many victims or survivors of priest abuse, what kind of response would you most like to see from the Archdiocese next?
I think the Archdiocese should become an open book to the people of New Mexico and saying, here we are. Here are our records. Here are our personnel files. We've redacted the names of victims, right, because we think that's private. But here is all of our correspondence. Here's what we knew. And here's what we didn't know. people don't believe the church's apologies are genuine right now because they still sense that so much is being withheld. So I think that the way you overcome that and start to rebuild trust is by having that kind of radical transparency.
Levi Monagle, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco. New Mexico's three Roman Catholic dioceses have begun the process of turning over thousands of records related to priest sex abuse and cover-up. In early September, Attorney General Hector Balderas gave church leaders a month to produce decades worth of documents. And as Public Health New Mexico's Hannah Colton reports, a spokesman for the AG says disclosures since then have been insufficient.
Most of the delay is due to sheer volume, says Deacon Jim Winder of the Diocese of Las Cruces. But he says they've also had confidentiality concerns because the AG's office had said they'd make all the records public.
And the problem with that is they're asking for even private medical records of the priests, and we can't do that without breaking other state and federal laws.
Winder says the AG has now agreed not to release that private information. He says the diocese expects to release a total of about 100,000 pages of documents, starting with about 10,000 next week. The Archdiocese of Santa Fe should have even more records based on the dozens of men they've named as being credibly accused of sexual abuse. They did not immediately respond to a request for comment. For KUNM, I'm Hannah Colton.
This is KUNM. I'm Madison Sprato. For three decades, a former priest who church officials say admitted to sexually abusing dozens of boys lived freely in New Mexico. A Catholic diocese in Iowa had sent Jerome P. Coyle to a church-run treatment center here in 1986. And then he stayed, potentially putting children at risk, even as the church remained silent about a history of abuse they now say he disclosed in Iowa. Public Health New Mexico's Hannah Colton reports Coyle was living with a family in Albuquerque before church officials removed him this summer.
It's not uncommon for the Ortiz family to invite a stranger in for a meal or even a night. They're devout Catholics. And 12 years ago, Jerry Coyle seemed like he could use a friend.
I was the choir director over at Risen Savior Catholic Community. And after the Mass, he came over and he seemed kind of lonely to me.
That's Ruben Ortiz. His wife is Tanya.
He just seemed like a very meek, lonely old man, yeah.
They took him to lunch. And from then on, they say Jerry became like part of the family. He was around for holidays, birthdays of their three young kids, daughters ages 1 and 5, and a 3-year-old son. It wasn't until they'd known him a couple years that he even told them he'd been a priest. Eventually, he told them that he had inappropriately touched a few children, but they say he downplayed it and assured them it was all in the past. Then, in November last year, Coyle was in a car accident, and he moved in with them while he recovered.
From the living room, you go in here to what is an office/guest room.
The Ortizes showed me the room in their house where Jerry Coyle slept for more than half a year. It was close quarters.
And the girls share a room, and Richard has his own room.
Richard's right down the hall. He's only, 10 steps away.
While Coyle was living with them, a letter came from the Diocese of Sioux City, Iowa. Coyle was told that he shouldn't be staying with a family with kids, that he'd get an increase in his monthly church stipend to find a different living situation. And the bombshell. The Ortizes learned from the letter that before Coyle moved to Albuquerque, he had revealed to his bishop a history of sexual contact with not a few, but about 50 preteen and teenage boys over a 20-year period. Attorney Levi Monagle has represented dozens of survivors of priest sex abuse in New Mexico.
I've never seen a letter quite like this.
The Ortizes hired Monagle to try to hold both Coyle and the church accountable. He says the Diocese of Sioux City should have gone to the police back in the 80s.
How could they in good conscience allow a man they deem to be dangerous to be exposed to children in New Mexico for 30 years? And is this symptomatic of a larger problem? How many Jerry Coyles are out there?
The New Mexico Attorney General announced a broad investigation into the state's three Roman Catholic dioceses this year. That followed a Pennsylvania grand jury report that outlined decades of covered-up sex abuse in the church there. For the Ortiz family, part of the saga ended this June, when church officials came and put Coyle on a plane back to Iowa. The diocese has moved him into a care facility near a school, according to the Associated Press. Law enforcement there has opened an investigation. Back at the Ortiz house, Ruben is excited to show me a religious music video the family made. They're so involved in the Catholic community, Ortiz says, it makes this betrayal especially painful. He says he's gotten no helpful response from church leaders. Talking with the Archdiocese of Santa Fe's victims' assistance coordinator only made things worse.
She made me feel like I was guilty. You didn't bring this to our attention for 3 months. I says, well, you know, you guys have kept this a secret for 35 years. So who's guilty here?
We've asked the Archdiocese of Santa Fe repeatedly for an interview for this story. They have not responded. Ruben and Tanya are terrified that Coyle may have done something to their son, Richard. Ruben himself was sexually abused as a child and says he didn't recall the incident until he was in his 30s. His son says nothing happened, but Ruben worries he could remember something years from now.
I think that it's affected us as a family, you know, the way we communicate, because our trust has been invaded.
The Ortizes don't go to Mass much anymore. They pray in their home for the type of comfort that they no longer get from Catholic church leaders. For KUNM, I'm Hannah Colton.
This is KUNM. I'm Kaveh Movahed. The Jesuits of the Central and Southern U.S. on Friday released the names of dozens of clergy they say have been credibly accused of sexual abuse of a minor. Public Health New Mexico's Hannah Colton reports one of the men identified has ties to a parish in Albuquerque's Old Town.
Alfonso Madrid was a Jesuit priest assigned to San Felipe de Neri Parish in Albuquerque in the 1960s. BishopAccountability.org places him there, as well as at the Los Duranes Church, between 1961 and 1966. Madrid was later accused of sexually abusing at least two boys in El Paso in the 1970s. The Jesuits and the Diocese of El Paso settled one lawsuit that named Madrid in 2013, according to the El Paso Times. Madrid also worked in Catholic schools and churches in San Antonio and in Mexico. He died in 1982. The Jesuits are a Roman Catholic order of priests and brothers who first arrived in Albuquerque 150 years ago. For KUNM, I'm Hannah Colton.
This is KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco. The Archdiocese of Santa Fe's bankruptcy process is underway, and a window is closing for survivors of priest sexual abuse to ask to be on a committee that will represent survivors in negotiating a settlement with the church. Public Health New Mexico's Hannah Colton reports a federal official is expected to choose the committee members sometime early in the week of December 17th.
There are about three dozen survivors who had ongoing lawsuits against the Archdiocese before it filed bankruptcy earlier this month. As part of the process, those three dozen were told they could volunteer to be on a committee that will hire an attorney at the church's expense and negotiate what kinds of compensation they want for all survivors. But there are likely other survivors out there who may want a say in those negotiations. Ford Elsesser, one of the attorneys representing the Archdiocese, says anyone with a claim of priest sexual abuse in the Archdiocese can try to get on the committee, regardless of whether they've hired an attorney or not.
A claimant does not have to be represented to participate in the bankruptcy, including asking to be on the committee.
Elsesser says the federal official who will oversee the bankruptcy is expected to interview candidates and choose 5 to 7 committee members in the next few days. For KUNM, I'm Hannah Colton.
For more information on how to volunteer for the Survivors Committee, go to KUNM.org. This is KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco. This week, 9 people were appointed to a committee to represent survivors of priest sexual abuse in negotiations with the Archdiocese of Santa Fe. It's an early step in a bankruptcy reorganization process that's meant to settle many sexual abuse claims at once. Public Health New Mexico's Hannah Colton explains.
When the Archdiocese filed for bankruptcy in early December, it says there were about 3 dozen pending civil cases alleging sexual abuse. The bankruptcy puts those lawsuits on hold.
In other words, they're stayed. They can't move forward. Everything would be funneled through the bankruptcy court.
Meredith Edelman has studied many Catholic Church bankruptcies closely. She's a PhD student at the Australian National University and a former corporate bankruptcy lawyer. The whole purpose of a bankruptcy, Edelman says, is to get a clear idea of what assets an organization has in order to distribute money fairly to creditors. And right away, things can get complicated. In court filings, the Archdiocese lists properties it owns all over New Mexico, many of which were donated to the church years ago.
We don't really know what its actual value is. If I were a creditor of the Archdiocese, I would be interested in having someone come in and do an appraisal of these various properties.
This tallying up of assets gets even trickier because the Archdiocese has split off various parishes into separate nonprofit entities in recent years. Edelman says it's unclear from court filings when this happened and what it means for the assets involved.
And the reason that this is important is because certain kinds of transactions can be undone by the bankruptcy court. And so if the debtor is, you know, within the few years before bankruptcy, giving away assets, then there's a real potential for the bankruptcy court to sort of claw some of those transactions back.
Each of these decisions, how to value and sell off property, how to divvy up the money, will be negotiated between the Archdiocese, its insurance companies, and the creditors committee made up of survivors. Prudence Jones was on the creditors committee for the Diocese of Gallup after it filed for bankruptcy in 2013.
When you become a committee member, it's a huge responsibility.
She says the committee members were mostly on the same page about what they wanted in the settlement. Jones says the only big sticking point was whether the diocese should have to publicly disclose their files on abusive priests.
I wanted the files to be public. There are very important things in those files that tell us patterns, behaviors of these priests, and possibly more locations of victims that we don't know about that were left in their wake.
The Gallup bankruptcy took 3 years, a relatively long and contentious process. And Jones never got the transparency she wanted from the diocese.
It was devastating to me. I really fought hard for those files, and I didn't want to walk away from what I saw as the one and only chance to get them.
It's uncertain if the Archdiocese of Santa Fe's bankruptcy process will provide any more transparency. Ford Elsesser is an attorney for the Archdiocese who's worked on over a dozen church bankruptcies before. He says in the end, the creditors committee will come up with a system which an impartial adjudicator will then use to decide how much to award each survivor.
That will not be made public unless the claimant decides that they want to make it public.
Before filing for bankruptcy, the Archdiocese of Santa Fe had settled about 300 claims for about $52 million. The Archdiocese has refused multiple KUNM requests for an interview with Archbishop John Wester. Elsesser says the Archdiocese is committed to a fair and transparent bankruptcy process.
From my experience, what most abuse survivors want is an acknowledgement, an apology, and fair compensation for what they went through. And I think that this provides the best opportunity to achieve that.
Survivors still have about 5 months to file claims of sexual abuse that will be settled through this bankruptcy. For KUNM, I'm Hannah Colton.
Support for KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Con Alma Health Foundation, and from KUNM listeners like you.